To me, the X-Men became about, it was actually about adults versus children. Because I felt that the whole thrust of the X-Men was actually about the generational thing, that people dislike their children because new ways of looking at things, and adults kind of don't like that because it's threatening to them. So I saw the X-Men as being about that, and basically that's where we took it in that direction. Basically about the war between adults and youth.
But I don't know if don't look at me.
I'm looking at you.
You got yourself into that.
I'm looking at you for validation, Stan. It's all I want.
You're listening to E for Evolution, examining Grant Morrison's X-Men, and we are your hosts. I am Perry.
Hi there, I'm Oscar.
This is Pat.
How you guys doing today?
Good.
Yeah, I'm good. The weather's starting to get a little bit warmer here in Australia, so I'm feeling good.
Nice. Yeah, same here. We finally seem to get out of the rainy season, so that's we're not flooding anymore, so that's good. So today we are talking, well, for us, we're talking again about New X-Men 117. The Zoom gods didn't like us when we recorded this last time, so we got to give it a second shot. But this is the epilogue issue to E is for Extinction. It's basically a one-shot issue titled Danger Rooms. Grant Morrison's the writer. This is the first time we've got a different penciler. We've got Ethan Van Sciver doing pencils on the regular issues. Prentice Rollins is the inker. Richard Sarkins and Comic Craft Saida are the letterers. Hi-Fi Design did the colors. Pete Franco, assistant editor. Mark Powers, editor. Joe Quesada, editor-in-chief. And Bill Gemmis is Marvel's president. So, guys, what do you think about 117?
We're trying to recreate the magic, by the way. So I feel like we have to redo our previous first time to y'all disclaimer about the Ethan Van Sciver-ness of it all, and just sort of own the issue, and just we acknowledge that. Perry said it better last time, so I think I'll let him say it again this time. But sort of like, you know, kind of trying to separate the art from the artist. So, and I did like the former, but then I'm going to turn it over to Perry because I did quite enjoy his description last time.
So yeah, for anyone who's listening and isn't aware of this, Ethan Van Sciver has, for the past few years now, he's been heavily involved in what's called in Comicsgate, which is basically this online movement of incels and misogynists who are trying to undermine anything comics does that doesn't feature straight white men, basically. And so, like, they've harassed numerous people. There's the infamous milkshake incident with one of the Marvel's female editors when they had posted a picture on Twitter a few years back with all the female editors from Marvel sharing a milkshake in honor of Flo Steinberg, I think it was, who was like the first woman who worked at Marvel. And like Comicsgate just went nuts on it. They went after Darwyn Cook's widow, and because they'd said Darwyn Cook would have been involved in Comicsgate. And she said, well, no, he wouldn't have. And they dogpiled on her, right? Going after a guy's widow, for Christ's sakes. And just, like, you know, nonstop hate speech and harassment, and just a, you know, a completely vulgar, disgusting movement. So if you want to dive more into it, you can search Comicsgate is a hate group hashtag on Twitter. They've been documenting, like, all the different stuff. One of the Comicsgate guys was even recently arrested for having child pornography too. So and it was disgusting. Yeah. So those are the people that Ethan Van Sciver associates with. And
so if you're like me, I had no idea of the background of this. I sort of steer clear of any of that stuff. So I got to just appreciate the art for the art itself. And it was easy for me to separate it because I just had no knowledge. And this book, when I first read it, I found it a welcome reprieve from Quitely's more, I don't even know the right word to describe Quitely's work in terms of traditional comics.
Maybe more like European style might be a good perhaps way to describe it.
It was just, yeah, wasn't traditional. This is a more of a return to a traditional comic book art. And I was super happy to have that come through when I first read it. And when I look at it now, I'm still pleased by the art. I enjoy it. I think it's he's a quality artist.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Ethan Van Sciver, he's a garbage human being, so that's not up for debate. But you know, credit where it's due. You know, Roman Polanski is another person who's a garbage human being, but he's a great director. You know, you got to give credit where it's due. And yes, Van Sciver is a really good artist. And I had the same feeling as you, Oscar, when I first read this issue all those years ago. I really liked seeing this more traditional superhero style, and it was cool to see these new designs rendered with the more traditional style, like Beast form and everything like that, and the new costumes. This is also the first time we get some slight alterations to the costumes that will kind of carry on throughout the rest of the series. This is when we see Jean Grey for the first time wearing the trench coat instead of just the regular, you know, short coat. Emma's wearing the usual Quitely design, so she's not wearing the altered one. But mm-hmm. I really liked the different take they gave on Jean here, and they gave her this trench coat instead. And I like that stayed through. It's a bit more evocative of the Phoenix imagery with the coat almost acting like a cape in a way.
Yeah, I sort of look at it as a bit more Matrix-like as well. This is the real Matrix influence with that trench coat too.
Yeah,
as opposed to the puffer jacket.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to say they seem hell-bent, at least in the movies, to sort of convey the Phoenix via this sort of trench coaty type thing too.
You know what, that's
which is not a design choice I agree with, but it sort of parallels what you're saying about sort of evoking that Phoenix silhouette, because they seem obsessed with, like, we got to put the Phoenix on screen. Oh, we know, trench coat.
You're right. I hadn't put those two together, especially because this came out long before Last Stand. Mm-hmm. In fact, this came out even before X2.
Mm-hmm. But in Dark Phoenix 2, which and this is hopefully the last distraction we'll take here about the movies, but with so many design options available, they still went with, well, we're going to put her in a trench coat because mm-hmm. that's what the Phoenix looks like.
I never thought of it, but you're right. You're definitely right there. Mm-hmm. That's weird. It's a weird choice. But
they made the same choice.
It's a weird choice.
And they did it twice.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's remarkable to me how they made Dark Phoenix terrible the first time, and they said, we're going to do it again, and they made it even worse the second time. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you screw up so bad twice.
And back to the art, I think this is good that we're re-recording it, because I don't think I said this last time, but I really appreciate artists who put a lot of detail and thought into their backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And if there's one thing Van Sciver is good at, that is one of them. Because I just appreciate the time taken to, like, putting some work and detail into it, as opposed to, like, sometimes there's some artists that do good figure work, but then the background is basically like a couple of different shades of color that's meant to evoke something, right? But here it's like there's forest, there's a school, there's liquid danger rooms, there's like this weird kind of almost like a beer brewery lab setup for Hank, which is, it draws the eyes, and it's cool things to look at, along with everything else.
Yeah, having, you know, started doing art myself, I can tell you from firsthand experience, backgrounds are a pain in the ass.
And oh, I bet.
It's so much work that goes into it, mm-hmm. for something that people are not really going to pay much attention to. And that's why in a lot of comics, you're right, they do have very minimalist backgrounds, especially in manga. Like, manga has very mm-hmm. minimalist backgrounds, or they'll do like, or they lean heavily on references like stock photography and then kind of tracing over it, that kind of stuff. And that's done because otherwise it would take them forever to get out any issues.
Right.
And, you know, yeah, I got to give him credit. Like these backgrounds are really well done in this issue.
They really are. I was rereading some comics as I do. And I reread the more recent from the more recent run, the Crucible issue with Lionel Francis Yu, and I noticed that the backgrounds in that were so blank. There mm-hmm. were scenes where, you know, there should be whole crowds of people and there was just barely outlines and all solid color for the filled in for the backgrounds, and it really distracted me. And I think it was, I thought to myself, why didn't I pick this up the first time I read it? And I suspect it's because I'm rereading these new X-Men issues in much more detail now that I'm picking up where things are being dropped in the current books, and the backgrounds are so detailed, it makes a huge difference. And it's one of the good things about the comics back then, I guess.
Like it lends an air to me of like, I don't know if realism is the right word, maybe fidelity. Mm-hmm. Because if this kind of background isn't there, it kind of gives a sense of like, oh, it's there's like actors in a sound stage, and I can tell it's a sound stage. But here it's like, no, it's this real lived in world with an environment, right?
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, it does make it feel like a lived in world. I want to take a quick break from the interior and just talk a little bit about the cover, because this, I think, is one of the best covers Quitely has drawn. I just love the way he depicts Beast in profile here, and just with the single tear rolling down his face. Like we talked about, we talked about in what will be the next episode, is that, you know, some of the covers during this era, they didn't really do a good job of reflecting what was on the inside. They were more like pinup style covers. But this is a good middle ground between those, I've always felt, because this, right, it's the character who is the focus of the issue. This is a very Beast-centric issue. And the tear rolling down his cheek, this is your first time reading the issue, you look at this cover and you think it's going to be about the fallout from Genosha.
Definitely.
But inside, it's, you know, we find out this is he's dealing with his stuff in his personal life. This is famously Trish Tilby breaks up with him, his longtime girlfriend breaks up with him in this issue over voicemail of all things. And and then he gets the shit kicked out of him by a mind controlled Beak. And so all of that is reflected in this very simple image.
Agreed. And I also think that nobody can do Beast as good as Quitely. And this profile picture of him is, well, it's actually a picture of his profile, both profile and profile. But I think it's really good cover. But I was someone that thought it was there was going to be an exploration in the fallout of the destruction of Genosha when I first saw the cover of the book. And that's not even touched on at all.
Mm-hmm. Pat, do you have anything you wanted to add about the cover?
I really liked how I think it evokes the main sort of emotional cores in the issue without revealing too much. Like you get a sense of Hank's emotional register, for lack of a better word, from the cover. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really give away what you're going to find inside, which I think is what makes it effective.
Yeah.
Sort of like the cover where you read the issue and you look back on it. I'm like, yeah, the creative choices that went into that makes sense now.
Yeah, yeah. I really like, going back to Van Sciver, I really like the way he draws the Beast's body, like in this first splash page, like the way, like that, it's a very dynamic shot of Beast leaping after, chasing after Beak there. But I'm not really a big fan of the way he draws the Beast's face. I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts about that?
It does. It does look a little bit like, I think I said before, like the lion from The Wizard of Oz. A little bit. Mm-hmm. and that's not my favorite depiction of Beast. I like the more feline look. The feline look of Beast is my personal favorite. I think previously he just had the Wolverine hair, which is weird. I don't like the ape version of him now. It makes no sense. The feline Beast is my favorite. Although I like the art in this issue, I have to say I did always prefer Quietly's Beast instead. And I think that no one was really able to, I sort of mentioned this with the cover, I don't think anyone has really been able to capture this version of Beast as good as Quietly has. Mm-hmm. It's really his definitive look. And that's a shame. I wish more people would give it a try. Bring back the feline Beast.
I guess I'm not enough of a Hank connoisseur to have a Hank connoisseur. It sounds so terrible saying in this issue. So I don't really have any strong opinions, but I do like regarding Hank, but I do like how I think Vince Skyver depicts him in a way that really showcases how physically powerful he is. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like Frank Quietly kind of obscures that a little bit with, it's a different take on it that I also enjoy, like sort of making him look very distinguished with like the collar and the sort of poofy chest thing. I'm not quite sure what you call that article of clothing.
Ascot.
Yes, that's it.
That's weird. I call it the Seinfeld, Seinfeld shirt.
that works too. But whereas I think Vince Skyver, and I think this just goes with like how he draws the outfits in general, like it's more form-fitting and you really get a sense of Hank's physicality.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Quietly had a tendency to draw Beast as more...
it's more like pontificating Beast, right?
Yeah. You don't really get it. He's a big guy, but you get the sense it's more like, I don't want to say fat, but it does.
No. But not at all.
He does look a bit more fat with Quietly. You can say it. It's okay.
Yeah.
No, I think it's more like the association that came to my mind right now is Hagrid. It's like I feel like Frank Quietly Hank is more like a Hagrid Hank.
Yeah, whereas Vance Skyvers is much more of a muscular Hank. Yeah, I agree with you in that, especially the way he draws like the torso and the legs. Like you got this like. The torsos, it's a bigger torso in both cases, but it's more angular with Vance Skyver's work. So we're introduced to one of Morrison's new characters who's going to become a player in this run, and that's Beak. So what are your thoughts about Beak?
I like how, and this is a theme that will continue in this arc, how Morrison is sort of playing with that regular X trope of the fledgling ingenue mutant, right? I thought it was an interesting, refreshing take because Beak doesn't seem like your typical go-getter. Definitely like, not like Kate Pride or Jubilee or like Paige Guthrie also comes to mind, though he's not like, I am so eager and ready to contribute and join the team, and I have an awesome power, and I'm ready to go. Like, Beak is none of those things. Mm-hmm. And I think
he has enthusiasm. Beak has enthusiasm, but unfortunately, none of the skill.
That's true.
That's what I like about him. I like that there was a character who wasn't perfect, who didn't have a six-pack, and was a bit kind of hopeless. And I think that's more what mutants are supposed to be, right? They're supposed to be these outcasts. They're supposed to be people that could be picked on. You know, who is going to pick on somebody that could shoot you with laser beams coming out of their eyes? I'm not going to bully that kid. Mm-hmm. But the kid... Oh, and
who looks like a supermodel, but by the way.
Yeah, exactly. That's not someone I'm going to bully. I'm going to bully the one that can't fight back, right? Not that I was a bully, but if I was going to, that's what I would do. And I think Beak is a better embodiment of that. I liked that. it was the first time I think we'd really seen that explored properly. Mm-hmm. We'd seen it maybe with the Morlocks, but they weren't really part of the X-Men. So it was cool. I think to link this to what we were speaking about before with the background as well, one thing I really love about this issue is it's the first time we kind of see the student body, mm-hmm. and all of them have weird mutant powers. Mm-hmm. There's very few ordinary looking mutants in the background of this school.
So it's cool that you mentioned the Morlock too, because I feel like the introduction of this concept that it's a school, there's a student body, it's populated by students, is kind of like fulfilling that promise a long time ago where Aurora was like, y'all can live in the mansion if you like, mm-hmm. but maybe not really, I don't know. So there was a miscommunication, they missed moving day, I don't know.
Yeah, there's a real beautiful mansion that you can come and live on for free, but right. instead you can live in the sewers with the shit.
I just imagine them rolling the Morlocks rolling up to the mansion one day and
they're Xavier, like, no.
Xavier just being like, oh, I'm sorry, nobody's home.
Aurora made that promise, not me. This is not her house. So and it's really interesting that you mentioned powers, because it's interesting that some of these figures, they may have mutations, right? But it may not necessarily be a power, if that distinction makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely,
yeah,
it does.
Very much. Yeah, and you guys are right. That's always been one of the things. There are a few examples I can think of, like Chamber comes to mind, or Skin comes mm-hmm. to mind, of people who were actually deformed or had, you know, difficulty blending in. But for the most part, like even the quote unquote ugly mutants, like, you know, Beast or Nightcrawler, you know, they weren't that ugly. Like, you know, Nightcrawler's got this Earl Flynn personality, and he's never had a trouble finding friends or finding lovers or anything like that. Beast nabbed a TV news reporter, so he had a thing with Dazzler for a little bit too. So.
Not to mention a certain Commander Brand, right?
Yeah, that's so. Right. Yeah.
Out of all of them, the only one for me that made sense was Abigail Brand, mm-hmm. because she had that comment of like, "Oh, my dad was a big furry alien, so I've got a soft spot for them," right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Okay, well, that makes sense. That makes sense." Mm-hmm. But as far as all of these other beautiful women falling over this hideously grotesque beast-looking man, it was always weird.
And I was gonna say, like, I think I recall in Generation X more than one instance of, I know Chamber has a big hole in his chest, right? Mm-hmm. But every female character was like, he's so handsome.
Yeah, he had the whole thing going with
got that British goth thing going, right? So, and it's like the hole in the chest only enhance mm-hmm. these other cute attributes.
Yeah, and even, you know, Paige and Skin had something going on for a little bit, if I recall correctly, didn't they? I remember some storyline like that in Generation X. So he didn't really have much of a problem either.
I don't think she did. I think they were always just like friends. I don't think there was any romance between Paige and Skin.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'm misremembering the story.
No, I think he kind of flirted with her a little bit and she was just like friendly back.
Okay. But yeah, you guys are right about the students here, and this was something that Morrison picked up from the movies and really kind of ran with the concept, because mm-hmm. one of the weirdest things about the X-Men has always been that, you know, for a while every super team in Marvel had some gimmick, right? Like the Avengers was like the celebrity football team, the Fantastic Four were a family of explorers, and the conceit of the X-Men was supposed to be, oh, they're a school, but they're a school that where they never go to classes, and they and nobody, and there's only ever like 10 of them at one time, and then eventually it became they're all, you know, 20 30 something years old and they're all living in a school still.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because now it brings to my mind, like, what a weird educational institution where you go from high school, college, and also apparently getting your graduate degree all in the same place.
And then you never leave.
And you yeah. and also a career. It's like self-contained, which Sign me up.
At my high school, we had one of my English teachers, my first year at school, ended up being, that was the high school that she went to as well. And I always thought that was crazy that you'd go to high school, have a couple of years at university, and then come back to the high school that you were a student 3 or 4 years later. You could actually be teaching kids that were in school when you were in school. It's weird.
I actually did have that experience myself, because for a while I substitute taught at my old high school before I moved to Japan.
Oh my God. What was that feeling like?
It was fun. I did have some crossover with people who were freshmen when I was a senior, and they were seniors when I was teaching there. So that was a little bizarre. Interesting. Yeah. But I did have, it was the weirdest thing though, was I remember I had started making friends with some of my old teachers. And one time they had invited me out to this faculty thing at a bowling alley. And I remember my student advisor, when I was in high school, she had had a few drinks. She didn't recognize me. And she was hitting on me at this bowling alley faculty
thing. Ew.
I love it.
And then she had asked, at one point, she's like, "You look familiar. Have I met you before?" And I'm like, "Yeah, you were my advisor." And then she's like, "I gotta go."
Yeah. Oh, you could have had a student-teacher romance, sort of.
Well, I feel like that's related with this issue, because I think Oscar, I believe there's some hidden references in this issue.
I think that's the next issue, isn't it?
Oh, is that the next issue?
Yeah, yeah. The sex in the background.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did they have it just there? Flick back to that last page. Was there? Was he doing it there as well? Just sort of noticed. So where it says God hates me,
maybe.
And then maybe not.
I feel like we've invented this game of like find the thing and
well, that's the fun of it, right? So,
yeah.
So for the people that are listening that don't know what we're talking about, in the next issue in particular, mm-hmm. the artist deliberately put hidden symbols that read out to say sex mm-hmm. in every he tried to do it on every page. The editorial staff picked up on a few of them, but quite a few seeped through.
Yeah,
and it's sort of fun on rereading to try and find where sex is written on each page.
We also get the first appearance of Glob Herman here in this issue. Mm-hmm. I did love that they just kind of had this guy standing in the background who later becomes kind of a bit player in the series and ends up becoming kind of a mainstay of the school, and he's always still around, just always in the background somewhere.
Yeah, 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Giving us actually a great recipe of, I can't remember that dish, but I think Laska. I'm going to try to make Laska. Yes.
But talking about Beak too, this is kind of this annoying little thing about whenever some writer comes in and introduces a bunch of new young mutants, is that eventually there will be another writer who comes in and decides, I don't want to use those new mutants that were created by the last guy. I'm going to create my own group of new mutants. And then there, all these other ones just kind of fall through the cracks.
I think a big part of this is, you know, because like, first of all, I think the first one was Kitty Pryde, right? Mm-hmm. And then for the next generation, it became Jubilee. And then we had New X-Men. And I guess for New X-Men, it was Beak. And then it moved over to Armor. And then we had the new X-Men students that really sort of took over from there. But I think one of the things is we kind of, with every series and with every writer, you almost need a point of view entry character for new readers. And a brand new student is a perfect one to illustrate that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to be something that's just going to constantly happen with the X-Men.
Yeah, yeah. It's unfortunate because it usually means that you get a lot of characters who are just going to disappear and never be heard from again.
And I think that's something the X-Office is really struggling with, especially like, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, it's been no real new characters that have stayed and have become prominent.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think like it also has to do with just the nature of the business. Like before with Claremont, he had decades to build that his mythology, which allowed him to develop characters like Kitty and mm-hmm. thus giving the character such staying power. Same thing with Lobdell to a lesser degree, with Jubilee. But I think it's kind of, I'm not quite sure what the common thread is, like which characters, I guess, stick around, because not all of them fade away, right? We mentioned Glob. I think M is still quite the player in the mythos, like not as much as I would like, but she's definitely a presence.
At least much more now than she was. Yeah. There was a time, I think Peter David deserves a lot of credit for that, because I think he really helped elevate her in X Factor. But for a while there, she just kind of like seemed like she was just going to disappear.
And you know, I think she's been a consistent presence, I feel like. So there was X Factor, and then she appeared in
she's an Uncanny Team with Magneto, right?
Uncanny Magneto, and then Weapon X, she was in there as well. And she's anyway, but yeah,
and Brian Woods version as well. Brian Woods, so she has been around for a while, actually. Yeah. Now that I think about it, but there was a good 10 years, I think, that there was no real Generation X character for a while. But with the students in particular, I think the background ones now, and what Morrison has done that no other writer did before, was to be able to introduce these very interesting background characters that they were able to touch on when they needed. And it's been ripe for all the writers following to be able to mine and explore. And that's why we're still seeing Glob and the Cuckoos and
Beak as well.
And Beak and Armour. It's why they're still popping up. And I think there's not many background characters from the Claremont times, right, that are popping up still 20 years later.
No, there were, I mean, you had the New Mutants, but they were all central characters.
But there
weren't really any. I mean, he had a few like human hangers on. Like there was, what was it?
Moira. Stevie Hunter.
I was trying to remember the name. And then there was also Tom Porcy, I think, was also hanging around at some point. But they just kind of like, I don't even know what happened to them. They just kind of disappeared one day.
Well, no, I think Stevie Hunter, didn't she become a congresswoman or a senator? I feel like that resurrection era that I didn't much enjoy, but I think she was there. She became some kind of senator, I believe.
Oh, okay. I remember that. Yeah. Claremont tried to bring some of that back when he did his second run, but none of it really kind of stuck around. And then here's this. And we had talked about this in our first attempt at recording this, because in interviews, they had really heavily teased the fact that there's going to be this Jean, Scott, and Logan, they're going to resurrect that love triangle, which had pretty much died, right? Like they had had the only time it really became, it was like in Extinction Agenda, there was that hint of it happening. But then when everybody came back to the mansion, it never really went anywhere. And so then it just kind of, then Morrison and Casey said they're going to be bringing it back. And there was the famous Casey's first issue, which had Jean and Logan kissing on the cover. And then there's this moment here where Jean's struggling with her feelings about Scott and with him after having been possessed by Apocalypse and just how distant they are. And she turns to Logan for comfort here. And they kiss and then he brushes her off.
I really think I've been thinking about this since the last time we spoke about this issue. And one thing I think we didn't mention that is really important is not only did they need to, you know, because this scene is fleeting and Logan pushes her away and says it would never work between us and just dismisses it. And they really need to touch on it so they could then explore Scott and Emma and all the rest of it. But I think the sexual tension between Jean and Logan in the film was so palpable that they had to touch on it in the comics again, because there were people that watched the film that then wanted to pick up the comics after. And I think without exploring that a little bit, it would have been wrong.
Yeah.
And I think this was a nod to the film in that way too. And I think because Morrison did mention in the manifesto that they had to bring elements of the film. There's a huge audience of people that went to the cinema, and we have to bring elements of the film into the book. And I really feel that's what Morrison was doing here.
It's a great sort of place, stage setting sequence, sort of establishing where the jumping off point would be. And I really like sort of the cap on the sequence with Emma sort of asking, where should I be pointing my eyes at, Scott? And I feel like that's Morrison also winking at the audience, like, where do you think you should be looking at? Like, the thing that just happened, or something else?
Well, yeah, Pat, I think it was you who brought this up when we talked about this the first time, and this scene, especially with Scott saying, try your left, and Emma is standing on the left for the reader. So yeah, that's it's a really good kind of, you know, misdirection, where it's like, oh, you thought it was going to be Logan, Scott, and Jean, but oh, here's Emma over here. And I do kind of like how it's handled here, because, you know, even though Logan has always been attracted to Jean, right? And even though he's always had this kind of like rivalry with Scott, there's the best depictions of this. They've always shown that even though he's got problems with Scott, even though they rub each other the wrong way, he respects Scott, right? And he's got a sense of honor. And so, like, I really like the fact that he just kind of says, like, look, this, you know, you and Scott belong together, and it would never work between us, right? I'm just kind of the guy you turn to when you're feeling down.
It's pretty hyper aware of Logan to realize that, right? And not just go for it anyway and be like, hey, I'll let you use me. I'm down for it. No worries. It's, you know, it's him having a little bit more integrity, but maybe it's him showing that his affection for Jean is so much more than just, you know, let's bang.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a big part of it as well. I don't like, though, how, even though it's a good rendition, I didn't like how Van Sciver obviously took a cue from Hugh Jackman in drawing Wolverine. Like, in my mind, Wolverine's supposed to be, he's supposed to be short, stocky, and ugly. He's not supposed to be, you know, a male bodybuilder or anything like that.
I think he's supposed to be quite muscular still, but I agree. I want him to be ugly. I want him to be especially short. I'm short. I'm 170 centimeters tall. And I'm cheering for the short guys. Short guys are kings. But I also think that Jean looks a lot like Famke Jensen, right, in this as well.
Yeah, maybe. I never really paid much attention to that, but you're right. And, you know, what you had mentioned before about taking in the chemistry from the movie, that's a really good point, because in those movies, and a big part of this because James Marsden was given fuck all to do, he didn't really have a chance to. It was really all the chemistry was with Jansen and Jackman.
Yeah. Poor Cyclops. He really, the movies have not really been great for him.
No.
I have a theory I wanted to run by you guys. We were talking earlier, previously, about secondary mutations. And I think Cyclops has a secondary mutation, but they haven't explicitly said it anywhere. Okay. And that is his brain can play chess with battle scenarios.
Oh, like the Netflix show starring Anna Taylor-Joy.
A little bit, yeah. But with battle confrontations and stuff. I think, like, especially in Fraction's run, that was really put forward, and that's why Charles sort of chose him.
For a minute there, Oscar, I thought you were going to say that his secondary mutation is a telepath catnip, which would make sense.
I think he just likes telepaths, because I think making love to a telepath would probably be the best that you could ever have, right? Because they would know exactly what you want, exactly the way you want, and what you like. There's no second guessing. So it would be fireworks every time.
Yeah. Or not, actually.
Yeah.
On the other hand,
I would definitely not want to be with a telepath. There's too much stray thoughts that go through my head that I'm just like, you know, you don't need to know what's going on in there.
Some secrets are good to have.
Some secrets are good to have, yeah. But I think that's kind of, that is a nice aspect of Scott's character, though, where he is, you know, he is this kind of, he's so focused all the time that having someone who he doesn't have to worry about conveying his conveying what he really means or something to them, because they can just know instinctively. I can see how that would be a relief for someone like him.
Definitely.
And here's where we get the big reveal that, you know, the worst kept secret, I guess you could say, because we'd all pretty much known after the last issue that Cassandra had taken over Xavier's body. And in the past, this would have been milked, right? They would have kept this going for 20 issues or so with just like these little references or these thought bubbles or something about like, oh, they don't realize that I'm actually Cassandra Nova. Just like, you know, when the Dark Beast had taken Beast's place in the 90s, right? There were all these little thought bubbles where he was like, oh, they, I hope they don't find me out, or I can't believe they trusted this guy with everything and all this kind of stuff. And they just kept on milking it for so long. And here, this is Morrison playing with conventions, because he's just like, oh yeah, she took over Xavier's body and we're not going to milk this. We're just going to have it happen right now.
That sequence, that two page sequence that's on the screen right now is so good. It's like the best kind of horror movie where like the tone shifts so quickly and dramatically, and you sort of, it's almost like this beast that sort of just pounces on you, because it just turns on a dime where Charles is seemingly calm and like just the regular Charles, you know, and then all of a sudden, bam, like he looks like this demonic creature with like yellow orange eyes and really, really looking creepy.
I agree with what you've said, both of you guys. I think it was really cool that it wasn't something that was drawn out for a long time, although he still does draw it out, but just in a different and new way. You know, Perry, I think you mentioned in the first time that Cassandra Nova sort of faces the X-Men, she blasts everyone and everyone kind of cops it. The Beast kind of remained a little bit unscathed, and it's almost like she saves it for now. And now when she hammers Beast, she does not hold back. She just goes all out. And I don't think he's suffered as much as this before or after. Really, she really rips him apart, both physically and mentally. My favorite thing about this and this scene in particular is the way the text goes from normal speech bubbles to almost lifting out of the screen. It's like when you're typing to somebody, you want to show that you're angry, you type in capital letters, and the art here takes that even further by pulling the text into the art, and it really does such a great job of evoking the sledgehammer just psychically smashing him.
Yeah, this is as a letterer myself, I really have to admire like the lettering that Richard Sarkeens and Saita did here on this page. And this is a perfect example of something that comics can do that no other medium can do in the same way, right? Just like the way the text is written here, the way it's floating around him as he's being psychically assaulted. You can't do that same thing and get that same effect in a movie. You certainly can't do it in a book. This is something you can only really see happen in a comic book. And I really love it when creators find a way to use the comics medium in a way that no other medium can do.
One thing I've just literally noticed now as well, because we're speaking about how detailed the backgrounds are, on this one particular scene where Cassandra starts to really hammer him, and it just shows Charles's evil face, Hank withering in agony, and the lettering and no background.
Yeah.
And I think that absence of a background here really adds to the intensity. It's like he can see nothing else. It's the art is really good in this issue.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing in the panel right before, right? Because you've got when Xavier does the reveal, you've got this like red background behind him, and that's it. And it's kind of like, it's almost like a transition into this mental, into this mindscape type scene.
And I really like the transition from like the thought bubble to like this, the text just sort of spilling out of it to be on the page. It's like this cool evocation of like she was talking before, but now the communication shifts to sort of like this direct psychic assault. Like she's not talking with words anymore. It's just with her powers. And I also really appreciate this take on psychic attacks. Mm-hmm. So it does the job of like having the psychic tell you what they're thinking, but not in the kind of goofball way where they're doing something, but they're explaining what they're doing. Like, and my go-to example of I'm summoning the sum totality.
The focus totality of my psychic
powers. Yes.
So I'm sure that every writer that has said that afterwards is laughing and taking a piss as they write it. For sure.
I mean, even Claremont has to be laughing every time he types it at this point.
The sum totality of, but I mean, Cassandra's doing the same thing, but kind of in a way that's organic and melds with a story, right? Because she's attacking me psychically by invoking these kinds of feelings. Right.
Yeah, I really love the fact that it's not just a pure mental attack. It's an emotional attack, right? She's attacking his insecurities. She's amplifying them. Because Beast has always been fairly well adjusted in terms of mutants who have physical transformations, who have physical mutations. But this new transformation, this new form, he's starting to feel it a little bit more than he has in the past. He can't use his hands as well as he used to. And Trish literally just broke up with him. So, and then for Cassandra to then come forward and just like, you know, hammer him with this and be like, you know, you're an animal, you're devolving, you're not evolving.
Can we talk a little bit about the kitty litter?
I was about to mention the kitty litter. Yeah.
Are we sure it's a kitty litter?
I mean,
it's a kitty litter. It's definitely a kitty litter. It is. It's got the broom. I was surprised that, and I'm being very serious here, I am so surprised that you guys thought that there was some ambiguity about the kitty litter.
I definitely did. Like, it's like geology or he's studying sand. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought the same thing because I thought there was... I couldn't just figure just the scenario of Beast working late in the lab and just being
tired. Oh, I can't make it to the eldest.
I've had too many burritos. I'm just going to pull down my pants and just, you know, pop a squat here in the kitty litter box. and then the robot brushes are just going to cover it up.
Yep. Well, now that I think about it, he doesn't feel the need to sort of bury it himself because he has that sort of broom arms that do that work.
I cleaned it all for him.
Yeah, yes. I mean, for the longest time, I had told myself that it's just like something else and it's incidentally, it looks like kitty litter. But then, Oscar, the first time we talked about this and you pointed out the brooms and I'm just like, okay, I don't think I can deny it anymore.
Yeah.
but she even says something, right?
Yeah. She does.
She mentions it in the text as well, where she's like, you know, use your doctorate degree to clean yourself, and sort of staggers him over near the kitty litter.
So yeah, it says here, I can't help but noticing the litter tray.
Oh, there we go. Mm-hmm. So it's explicit.
Mm-hmm. But that's what I thought. I thought she was like, she's mean. Explicit. I thought, yeah. So I thought she was just being
she's a bad person.
Yeah. I didn't think it was actually kitty litter, but you have convinced me, Oscar.
Thank you. I've won. I love these small victories.
But now that I think about it, isn't it interesting, right? Like, so we're already in agreement. She's a pretty vicious character. Mm-hmm. She's a very cruel character. But the sort of shift, like this notion of Hank proudly having a kitty litter. Like, presumably it's not an issue. Presumably the other X-Men are aware that they...
Well, I mean, it's like right that, in the middle that, of the laboratory.
Right. Like,
I mean,
like that's a thing that he's doing and it's fine, right? It's like it's an experiment in like mutant living or whatever, and it's okay. And now Cassandra Nova's like shifting that sort of, I guess, exploration that Hank is doing with himself into this attack. Like,
I can just imagine Logan coming to visit Hank in the lab and being like...
What's that
smell? Yeah. It's like, it's nothing, Logan. Your mutant powers are acting up.
It's an experiment in mutant living. Okay, I'm exploring the frontiers of my identity. Thank you. So,
I always thought it was something to do linked with his evolutionary change, right? That he was he mentions he's not able to use a pen anymore. And I was thinking that it was something to do with, like, you know, he can't use the toilet paper. He needs to sort of go to the bathroom a different way. It's disgusting to think about, but it's also a bit more like, what, is he going to go and sit on a toilet? He'd break the porcelain seat.
Well, and now that
it's like 600 pounds.
Perry, I think you and me should be ashamed that we didn't catch that the first time, because that's a Grant Morrison thing to do.
Yeah, like, I don't think we have ever before or since explored the toilet habits of the X-Men as much as Morrison did in this issue.
Well, the litter in the room invites the discussion. I mean,
definitely.
I also do like this, how he says, I can turn the periodic table into a dirty rhyme. And he says, hydrogen's a kind of gas the Big Bang blew out of its... And then he...
Mm-hmm.
So I did like that little touch there. And then this scene of Beak just going to town on him. This whole, like, everything that's done to Hank, it is, like, we've used this word before, it's extremely visceral.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And just that final scene of just Hank's glasses, one of the lenses is smashed and they're just, you know, lying in the puddle of blood, which again is another example of not much of a background. It's just that dark background and then the blood and then the glasses.
And it still works, because I think that should be the focus of that panel.
Oh yeah, it works perfectly, is what I'm saying. Yeah.
And I think even if that were like the real world, like, it would still make sense. Like, mm-hmm. that's what that would look like.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
I like that they are showing actual blood instead of just black ink.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think from my memory, this was the start of them being able to do that,
yeah. with
breaking away from the Comics Code Authority. And I think it adds to that visceral depiction of violence.
Oh, hate. They did have some weird internal standards, because I do remember during... I think it was the Siege storyline, where you had this really graphic panel of Sentry tearing someone apart, but they still censored the
spine out or something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, but they, mm-hmm. I think he like tore Ares in half or something like that, but yep. they still censor swear words.
Because violence is okay.
I guess, but, so, yeah.
Yeah.
This is America.
It's America.
This is America.
And this final scene with, the Shi'ar coming by, and we had mentioned this before, but I do like how we're reminded here, because we've kind of forgotten over the past, what, like 30 years or so, that the fact that the X-Men are friends with an interstellar space empire is really kind of an amazing thing. And you see all these students around, you know, they're taking photos of it, and Xavier's like, you know, why is everybody walking around taking photos? What's going on? What's so special about this?
Well, there's a big alien spaceship outside.
One thing I love, and it's one of the very few things that actually date the comic, is that when the students are taking photos, they're all holding handheld cameras or VCR camera recorders.
Yeah, one guy's
stuff.
Got the camcorder thing, I see.
Yeah, that none of them have their mobile phones. And that's just a lot nice little thing that 20 years ago, everyone didn't have mobiles, certainly not students.
No, I remember I did have a cell phone when this came out when I was in high school, but it was in this like bulky Ericsson thing with just
it
like
definitely wouldn't
display.
Have had a camera.
Definitely yeah. No camera, and it was one of those things that would cost like, you know, $10 a minute to make a call, so I could only use it for emergencies.
I had a mobile phone when this came out as well. I was 18 and living out of home, so I definitely had a mobile, but it was, I think I had a green screen on the back of
yeah,
it. With,
yeah.
You know.
I think I had a Nokia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was either Ericsson. Nokia or Ericsson. It was one of those I had.
I definitely had the Ericsson.
Now that you mentioned the cameras, it's an amazing, like, there must be, I guess, some kind of film studies offering at Xavier School for gifted youngsters, because there's quite a few of them with camcorders.
But I also love that Emma's using her opera glasses.
Oh, yes, indeed.
It's the look. It goes with the look. It's really the opera glasses really show her character.
Mm-hmm.
Right? She doesn't need them. The spaceship is ginormous.
Yeah.
And they're right next to it. You know, she does not need the opera glasses. It's like a very Mariah Carey.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I also love that they've got this, they haven't shown the Shi'ar craft, right? They've talked about it being here, right? Mm-hmm. And the only thing we get, we have this little star in the background in this one panel when Logan and Jean are together. So all this time, you know, Emma's trying to look, and then you actually see it, and you see it's this gigantic thing that's like 10 times the size of the mansion.
Mm-hmm.
I think we spoke about that previously as well, that the proportions of the ship help evoke the enormity of the Shi'ar Empire. Mm. You know, because the ship is just it's more than twice the size of the house. It's huge.
Yeah.
And of the mansion, rather, not the house. And that's a good indication for people that don't know anything about the Shi'ar. It shows you straight away, wow, this is big.
And that's only one ship.
Yes, exactly.
An interstellar empire. Although I have to say, Oscar, I really love the Mariah Carey reference there, as a big fan of her as well. I thought that was quite brilliant.
She's won me over. Makes over the sense. Years. I was never, I, she's won me over.
You know, every year at Christmas time here in Japan, all the stores blast two songs. Wham's Last Christmas and Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas. Yeah, so I despise both of those songs now.
I think that's not just Japan. I think it's the entire world.
Their world, yeah.
And it's such a stroke of genius that Mariah Carey made that All I Want for Christmas song, really, because it's going to feed her family for generations to come.
Yeah, yeah. And beyond, same thing with George Michael's family.
Yeah, I think they'll be living off Last Christmas for a while too.
Oh yeah, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also the detail Van Sciver did on the craft here and the Shi'ar spaceship is amazing, right? That's just some next level detailing there.
And it's exceptional in the sense that, like, it's not necessary. Like in mm-hmm. the sense of like there are other artists who draw similar things and seem to get past editorial, right, without lending it this kind of detail,
mm-hmm.
which I think makes it so exceptional, right? Yeah. Like he didn't have to do it, but he did.
I think there are only two other artists I think of who would have put this level of detail into something like this. One is George Perez, and mm-hmm. I can see three. George Perez, Alex Ross, and Brian Hitch.
Mm.
I think those are the ones that really come to mind as ones who would do this kind of level of detail.
What about? Mm-hmm. What was Jimenez, I think his name is.
Phil Jimenez.
Phil Jimenez.
Yeah, I think he could have done something like that.
He probably would have, yeah, yeah.
If I look at Chris Barklow's early Generation X art, that period, he's mm-hmm. doing a lot of really detailed stuff in the backgrounds and stuff as well. But, you know, even so, we've just picked out maybe four or five artists.
Mm-hmm.
There's literally hundreds of comic book artists, I think that.
Yeah.
That sort of shows that.
I mean, Hitch and Perez are probably just the ones that jump out in my mind that this is probably the most evocative of.
Definitely, I agree. I agree with you.
Another thing, too,
my favorite shot, though, sorry to interrupt. My favorite shot at the end of this is not the Shi'ar ship, and it's actually the second last page where Charles is like looking up at the ship and the light's shining down on him, and he's saying, you know, imagine all that power of the Shi'ar.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the creepiest shot.
Yeah, mm-hmm. the use of shadows with that smile is just really well done. And also another thing is the metaphor here of the ship compared to the mansion, right? Because we start out at the mansion, we started very small scale, and this is a hint that, you know, the story's going to get much bigger from here.
Mm-hmm.
True. I never thought of that. I never looked at it that deeply before, but you're right. You're very right.
Is this the issue where they made a reference to Charles's ex being the empress of a space empire?
Yeah, that was during the conversation with Jean and Logan.
Yeah.
Here we go. She said, maybe he said, leaving us to deal with the mob at the Institute gates. Maybe I'd do the same if my ex ran his own space empire.
Right. Which is another great bit of sort of Morrison acknowledging continuity in history, but in a way that's not obtrusive. Mm-hmm. Right. Because, I mean, as a reader, you have all you need to know about the Shi'ar and Lilandra and what her relationship is.
Yeah. Well, also, there's also a reference to what's happened in the other books too, when, mm-hmm. you know, Beast says that we have 5 permanent teaching staff along with field agents. So that's a reference to the team over in Uncanny.
Uncanny. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So any other final thoughts you guys want to say about 117?
I liked it. I think overall it was a good issue. It's a good slowdown of pace after the E for Extinction arc. I was excited to see the more traditional aspects of comic book art being represented in this run. But except for Beast, quietly is the Beast King in terms of art in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it for the most part. I thought it was a nice bridge from E for Extinction into the arcs to follow. I thought it was a fantastic cliffhanger. And Morrison performs this great feat of, like, we pay off the Cassandra Nova being in Charles's body thing, but there's still this cliffhanger of, well, what now? Now she's going to mess with the Shi'ar Empire, and what would the fallout of that be, right? So it's this cool feat of, like, we resolve this mystery, but Cassandra
Nova really.
Is still an ongoing threat,
right?
She's still in the background, and she's probably going to come back at some point.
Spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
But well, yeah,
I mean, the promise of that last page is like, she's not done with y'all. She's going to come back.
It's still the dramatic irony is kept, mm-hmm. right? While revealing, you know, we were speaking earlier about how normally, like, they would drag this on and on and on, but it reveals straight away that Cassandra Nova is inside Xavier's mind. And Morrison does sort of subvert that by letting the characters know straight away, but he also doesn't, because Beast is put into a coma and so is Beak, so no one else really knows except for the readers, and everyone else is comatose. So it's a good way of having that reveal without having that reveal.
Yeah.
I do just want to, like, I'm not now such a fan of his depiction of Emma in this issue. I know he draws her again later on in Imperial, which I think is a lot better. Because in this issue, I feel like she kind of looks like a Barbie doll.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of, like, see the seams in the doll with the way that he draws this outfit. So I'm glad he would make the choice later on to sort of go with a more with a trench coat look for her.
Yeah, I agree with that. Just echoing a lot of what you guys had said. I've always liked those kind of, you know, slow issues of the X-Men books when they just kind of, like, hang around the mansion. Lobdell was really good at doing those. And
yes, it's where you get the most character beats, right?
Yeah.
It's when you really fall in love with the characters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it is nice to see Morrison doing one of those kinds of issues and having this break from the big action. And the nice thing about the Cassandra reveal and not milking it is that usually, you know, they'd be biding their time at the mansion until the time was right. But in this issue, we get a definite sense of Cassandra moving a plan forward. Like, her first step was Genosha. Second step was taking Xavier's mind or taking his body. Third step is the Shi'ar Empire. So there's this definite progression. There's this definite execution of a strategy we see happening. And I really like that.
Well, and she also took a detour to... let's just out everybody living in this mansion.
Yeah, mutants. And leave them and leave everybody right. Leave them to deal with the mob while I go off. Yep.
As vulnerable as I can, right?
Yep.
Keep them busy.
Yeah, so it's a really good issue. It's a nice change from the art, and it's a nice tease to what's going to be coming next. So it's a way to kind of decompress after the last issue while still moving the story forward. Okay, so that does it for our discussion about New X-Men number 117. Guys, do you have anything you want to promote before we close it up?
You can see my little ramblings on Twitter at ODAT220.
And my Tumblr remains Perfect Faberge Killing Machine. I'm also working on another podcast called Krakoan Exports that's focusing on the Hickman era. And we hope to start posting those episodes soon.
Okay. And all my stuff is at percivalconstantine.com. You can find my books, my art, all that stuff is through there. My other podcast is superherocinephiles.com, and where we talk about superhero movies. And this show, you can find us at eforevolution.transistor.fm. You can email us at eforevolutionpodcast@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram, MorrisonXPod, on both of those. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you next time when we begin talking about germ-free generation. E for Evolution, examining Grant Morrison's X-Men, is produced by Percival Constantine, with theme music by Aaron Kenny. Audio of Grant Morrison and Stan Lee was recorded at San Diego Comic-Con 2008 and provided by bravogabo.livejournal.com. You can find E for Evolution on Twitter and Instagram at MorrisonXPod and on the web at eforevolution.transistor.fm. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email address is eforevolutionpodcast@gmail.com. Support the show by leaving us a review at Apple Podcasts, which helps us reach more listeners. Special thanks to the members of the House of X Facebook group for their encouragement in getting this show started.